Welcome to the Business Radio Network. Enjoy Small Biz, Big Voices with Stephanie Rising.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Rising, a business coach and author in beautiful Tucson, Arizona. Being a small business owner is rewarding, but can feel lonely. Few people understand what it's like to sweat payroll, market themselves as a brand, or create revenue streams from scratch. For the next hour, join your tribe on Small Biz, Big Voices, the podcast that celebrates the stories and impact of your fellow small business owners. Today, we're going to visit with Sherry Romanofsky of Sherry's Desert Harvest. Our interview will conclude with a Proust lightning round, and our final segment will be Dear Coach, when I'll coach listeners through issues they've emailed in. First, it's my pleasure to introduce Sherry Romanofsky, the owner and founder of Sherry's Desert Harvest. Sherry is a native Tucsonan who grew up appreciating the desert and its natural resources. As an elementary teacher, Sherry taught children about the flora and fauna of the Sonoran Desert and how Native Americans survived on its bounty. She later utilized this knowledge to preserve many fruits grown on her own property and provide her husband and three children with all natural, healthy preserves. The excess production was given to neighbors, and they soon began sending over unusual fruit grown on their own property for Sherry to preserve for them. Payment for this favor came in the way of special homemade goodies made in their own kitchens. As a result, Sherry learned how to make many different varieties of preserves, some of which she continues to make for her own business today. Since 1985, her homespun hobby has blossomed into a national and international business. Sherry continues to take extra care with each product by hand harvesting, processing, and preparing all of her products in small quantities to ensure product quality and integrity. She still uses no artificial flavoring, coloring, or preservatives, just nature's finest fruits and vegetables. Sherry's numerous accomplishments have earned her recognition as a 2019 finalist for the Women of Influence Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Sherry, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm excited to share some of our history and what we do today with our listeners.
Good. I have been very excited about this interview. I've wanted you on the show since I started this podcast, so I'm geeking out a little bit.
Me too.
I'm always fascinated by businesses that are started in someone's home, particularly when they involve transforming a well-established path like teaching into something entirely new, like, manufacturing products from indigenous plants. I mean, that's quite the leap. Can you describe for us how you came to create Sherry's Desert Harvest?
I can. As a young mother, I had one child at that time and decided I wanted all natural and organic food for her. And so I started preserving fruits and vegetables that grew in our garden. And as the story told, we shared with neighbors until one of my neighbors said, "My cupboards are full. How about starting a business and selling it?" Well, we all laughed. We thought that would be so funny, somebody actually buying my products. But I thought, I need a second income. So I thought maybe I'll do this until I go back to teaching. So I began making berry preserves and mustards and fruits that really weren't indigenous to this area. And I canned them and I sold them at little farmers markets and so forth until one day I decided, I am competing with many companies on the market like Smucker's, et cetera. And I thought, nobody else works with indigenous fruits and vegetables. So I thought I need to do that. And I remember teaching my students about the wide diversity of food plant species out here and their history and how they were an important part of our Native American lifestyle. And so I decided I would work with that, but no one did what I do. So it was very challenging to try to figure out how to can these types of fruit and vegetables that you can't find on the market nor in a book.
I think that perfectly captures the entrepreneurial spirit of what you do, because you recognized that there was this unfulfilled niche. And I think people tend to gravitate naturally toward what they know, and you gravitated toward the unknown. And I think that that's one of the reasons why your products are so exceptional.
Thank you.
Your crews hand harvest 40 tons of fruit per season, and all of it is processed locally at your facility. And I don't think many people know this about you, and this was one of the reasons I was so excited to have you on the show. You are the only company in North or South America to produce prickly pear seed oil, and you do it right here in Tucson. Why was it important to you to keep the manufacturing here in Tucson, and how did you figure out a process for something no one else was doing?
Well, that, you know, I guess that's why I enjoy being in business. I love the challenge of taking something from or making something from nothing. And I wanted the manufacturing plant to be here that I had total control of my end product. That was paramount to me. The products that I wanted to serve to my family, I wanted to be able to offer to people in the marketplace. So by keeping it in-house and processing it myself, I could control every aspect of that end product and not rely on a co-packer, not knowing that the integrity of that product would remain in place. Our largest product that our crop that we process is prickly pear, and so we needed to learn how to harvest and process, store, and cook it into a finished product. So through a lot of experimentation, mistakes, etc., it took me actually 2 years to get the prickly pear jelly to actually be consistently good. And we continue to change that through the years to improve. But I think with the prickly pear seed oil, that was exciting to me, to be able to take what we actually were throwing away, this rich resource that's so full of antioxidants and vitamins and anti-aging properties, that we actually could take what we would throw away and make it into an end product. And you'll find out as we discuss how we use every part of that seed and plant.
And we're definitely going to get into that later in the interview, your philosophy of waste to profit. There was something that you just touched on in your answer that's a perfect segue. The next thing that I wanted to ask you is, I imagine there was a tremendous amount of research and development going into this, and you said that it was 2 years in the making just to get a jelly to gel, so to speak. You know, becoming a good cook, let alone a manufacturer who's able to create original recipes, it's largely a matter of trial and error. And I imagine that's even more true when your primary ingredient is cactus. So what was your process for developing a new recipe? Like, how do you first get an idea, and then how do you go about creating something knowing that you have to do it on a mass scale?
Those are good questions. Developing a recipe actually takes a little ingenuity and creativity to think about the product and what you want to do with it. And then you investigate, and you have a whole lot of patience in working with it because you have to experiment with it. And preserving fresh fruit is not an easy thing to do. You need to work with it on many, many times to perfect what you want at the end. You conduct multiple experimental batches of jelly to learn what works and what doesn't. Many of my finished products took me sometimes years to finalize to where I was happy with it. I am very particular about the color, very particular about the flavor. So to get that on the market, after a lot of experimentation and failures, and as you say, trial and error, you finally if you pursue and you have, you're tenacious about it, you do find that finally get to that recipe that you really like. Then to take it to the mass market, that's a very interesting direction to go in, because you need, first of all, to make sure that you weigh every ingredient that you work with. Because if you want to make it into large batches, you need to be able to multiply the weight of the ingredients so you are duplicating what you created in a small batch into a large batch. And sometimes there can be some chemical changes with that. So,
interesting.
So what you absolutely need to do, if you want to pursue that recipe that you love and you want to create it in larger batches, take small steps and double it, then triple it, and then quadruple it, and then go 10 times, then 20 times your original recipe. Because if you don't, there is a chemical, could be a chemical change, and what you did with your small batch to 20 times that batch, it could be a failure, a major failure. So you've lost all the ingredients, but you have too many variables in the creation of that product or duplicating into a larger mass batch. So I would just suggest having patience and work with it a little bit at a time.
So it sounds like a huge chemistry experiment.
You know, it is.
Yeah.
It is.
Like, even though the math works, the chemical process of it is not guaranteed. Like, it didn't even occur to me that you would have to make the same recipe 10 times over in different quantities just to see what the tipping point would be.
Absolutely. And this is an interesting story, because when I was really getting frustrated with prickly pear, I could not consistently get it to jelly. And I learned about a food chemist here in town. He was retired from Chicago. And I introduced myself, and he invited me into his home. He had a laboratory right there in his home. And he was teaching me the importance of chemistry in making jelly. And he was floored that I was so ignorant in chemistry. Well, I didn't realize how much went into the making of food and how it does involve chemistry. So with his patience and many, many meetings with me, and he invited me into his laboratory to learn about all the different aspects of making jelly and how does it become jelly. He just really took me under his wing, and I would seriously not feel I would be here today with my business without his assistance and help.
It is a far cry from just going home at the end of the day and whipping together some dinner. I mean, I had the opportunity to see your facility last week, and I felt like we were in a small version of Willy Wonka's factory. and just the enormity of product that you have to turn that into a final product, it really hit me how expensive and oopsie could become. And that leads me to the question. I mean, I'm sort of notorious in my family for some of my experimental cooking.
Wonderful.
My family, I think, is emotionally scarred over the years from trying things like, you know, curried tuna and broiled kiwi, which is not the slab of caramelized deliciousness that was advertised. So especially when I was younger and learning how to cook, you know, both my parents worked full time. And so I would try and pitch in and help make dinner and whatnot. So it was easier on my parents. But in teaching myself how to cook, I came up with some spectacular concoctions that half were edible, probably. I imagine you had some strange concoctions yourself over the years. Again, I mean, dealing with some very unusual ingredients. What was a recipe that you worked on and the result wasn't what you had in mind, but you learned something from it?
Oh, that's a great question, because so many of my mistakes have turned into some of my best successes. One of them that I remember quite well is my jalapeno jelly. Even though there were jalapeno jelly on the market and there were recipes for pepper jellies, I didn't like them. And so I worked, it took me 3 years to formulate a recipe that I really liked and I felt that I could go to market with. Mm-hmm. My philosophy is if I'm not going to feed my children and my family that product, then I don't want to offer it on the market. Mm-hmm. And I wanted the buyers to eat it and say, this is exceptional. It's different than any other jalapeno jelly on the market. I want to buy it, and they buy it on a regular basis or share it with friends and family. And that's a great honor to me if somebody wants to share my jelly with someone as important as their family members. Mm-hmm. That jalapeno jelly now is really exceptional. It takes 2 days to cook that jelly. Wow. Because I take extra steps in making sure that I pull as much flavor out of it as possible. I focus on the natural color mm-hmm. of my preserves. I don't add any coloring. There's no additives, preservatives, coloring, etc. It's just pulling the beautiful color and flavor and sense of fresh produce. Mm-hmm. And we start with fresh produce. Everything that we work with, we bring in fresh that's grown locally.
The color of your prickly pear syrup is so beautiful. I've
Thank
made
you.
Many a gorgeous margarita what? Out of that syrup. It's the perfect thing to make for people who are coming from out of town and they're visiting because it's such a local
yes.
flavor and color. My relatives in upstate New York, I mean, they don't have prickly pear, and B, I don't know if they have anything that color
yeah.
back there. It's really cool. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you.
And one quick thing before we take a break, what when you were producing all of this, I mean, you produce your products with so much heart and with keeping the end user in mind. What was your hope that their experience would be after, you know, all of this thought and the research and development, and you finally pulled this all together and you put it out on the market? And what were you hoping people would feel?
Well, initially, I just thought, I just hope they like it and would like to serve it to their families. But it is amazing how many stories I get, how many people visit our little factory here that call from states all over the United States, and we have visitors from foreign countries come over mm-hmm. that rave about the flavors that I've achieved, mm-hmm. and so it's just been exponentially positive to me that something that we took from nothing and yeah. created is enjoyed by so many people. And I think that's been the greatest joy of my business life, is to meet mm-hmm. and hear from people from so many walks of life, from all over the world. It's just really enriched my life and made me feel like I want to keep giving my very best in my products.
And you can taste it in every bite.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. For those joining us, I'm Stephanie Rising, a business coach and author, and this is Small Biz, Big Voices, the podcast that celebrates the stories and impact of small business owners. We're broadcasting on Tucson Business Radio X, and with me today is Sherry Romanofsky, owner and founder of Sherry's Desert Harvest. Before returning to our interview, I'd like to announce that I'm leading a one-day dynamic marketing workshop on Friday, March 8th. You can find additional details on the Rising Effect Facebook page or email me at stephanie@therisingeffect.com. Sherry, I think now more than ever, consumers are beginning to align their purchases with their values. Even in an era of political divide, I know both progressives and conservatives who see the need to reduce their eco footprint. And this seems particularly true for millennials who are environmentally conscientious, and they are now the largest living generation of consumers. You practice a much needed business philosophy that you call waste to profit. Can you describe for us what does this mean and how have you incorporated it into your business?
That's a great question as well, and it's one I really hope to impart to anyone who owns a business, especially a manufacturing business, in hopes that they'll ask the question, what if? What if we take the waste we are generating and turn it into something viable to profit their company or perhaps another company or a nonprofit organization? To reduce the waste in landfills, we truly have a responsibility in my mind as business people, as manufacturers, to try to reduce some of that waste. And it'll be amazing. I think people would be amazed at what they can create by simply asking that question. The waste not, want not philosophy that I've had in business created this desire to take the pressed material that I take from the prickly pear fruit. I steam the fruit, and then we press all the juice out for my jellies and my marmalades and syrups and candy, etc. And it's the pressed fruit that is the skin, are the skins and seeds that I used to donate to ranchers to as a dust to reduce dust in their corrals. But I always knew there was something more valuable than just as a dust reducer. So I experimented many times with that pressed material. I originally thought I could make a pressed log that people could use in their fireplaces. And the company, Green Valley Pecan did that with their pecan shells. So I thought that was such an ingenious idea. But the company that made those logs went out of business. So I kept thinking there's got to be something else. It wasn't until I was contacted by a young lady in France who wanted to do an internship here in Arizona with me to valorize or find the value of the waste of prickly pear by extracting oil. She knew that all over France it's very, very popular, is the seed oil from prickly pear. So she introduced me to that. We worked for 6 months together, tirelessly figuring out a way of doing all of this. And we do similar, we work with it similarly than when she was here, but we do different things. And it's the whole philosophy is to take the waste, find the value that you can from that waste, and extract what you can from it as a profit. For profit for my company. Now, the waste from some of the processes, we are actually able to donate to two nonprofit agencies here in Tucson, and they, in turn, it becomes a profit for them. There is absolutely no waste at the end. And my feeling is that I am honoring Mother Nature, who has blessed us and given us this wonderful fruit that's thousands of years old, has fed Native Americans for thousands of years, and are still giving back to us. So it's sort of a way of honoring that wonderful creation she brought us.
I love that. So everything that you produce either is shelf-stable and sellable,
right?
Or it's compostable,
right? But every chain of that becomes a profit
right,
to someone. And this is where I'm hoping that businesses will look at it not even if it's not a profit that they can actually make, but someone else can. At least you, A, are reducing the waste in landfills, but you're also utilizing to the max something that you would normally throw away. So it becomes more sustainable. It's environmentally friendly. So I just think it's a better way that we all have to think of in the way of being responsible to our environment and to nature.
And being good stewards of the resources, kind of pairing that with a curiosity leads to profit.
Absolutely.
I mean, you didn't know at first what you could do with prickly pear seed.
Right.
And you would think that's just pure waste. But as it turns out, it's an incredibly valuable oil that is now being sought out by cosmetic companies.
Absolutely.
And so something that would have ordinarily been maybe compostable or worse, it would have wound up in the landfill, is actually something that an entire industry is actively seeking out. So kind of moral of the story is get curious, because you never know where some dollars could be hiding underneath something that looks invaluable.
Absolutely. And again, we've solidified that idea by all the contacts we've had from people, again, from all over the world. A lady from Saudi Arabia came in who actually uses the prickly pear seed oil on her patients that have skin cancer, because it has high healing properties, high antioxidants. It is just a wonderful oil that actually our Native Americans knew that long time ago. They used the fruit juice on skin ailments and stomach ailments. But this oil is very rich and something that really only two companies that I knew of when we started that produce it. And one is in, and they're all in Northern Africa. So we are, and we've been asked by them to come out and teach them how to use the whole fruit. They raise prickly pear and they throw away 90% of the fruit just for the seeds. So they've asked me to come out and teach them how to make a finished product with that 90%. So
how exciting.
That would be very fun. I'm looking forward to that someday.
Oh, that's great. And I see that as an extension of this. I mean, it's not just something that you practice in your own business, but it's something that you want to actively help other people figure out how to implement in their own. And kind of along those lines, in terms of stewardship of resources and limiting our waste, my next question is inspired by one of our listeners, Leanne, who is a cook and she loves your products. And so, again, in keeping with that theme of being eco-friendly, there are a lot of non-indigenous plants that seem here to stay, for better or for worse. They consume water. Many people aren't aware of their culinary potential, so they don't get repurposed into anything. Do you work exclusively with indigenous plants, or would you consider using something like ornamental oranges in your jellies? And I know that those are extremely sour, so maybe they have a more savory application. But what is your philosophy around that?
Well, I have worked with ornamental oranges. I've worked with Seville oranges, kumquats, loquats, calamundins, etc., in marmalades. But they didn't sell real well. So they eventually were left to the wayside to concentrate on some of those other ones that did move a little bit faster. But we are working right now with Mission Gardens here in Tucson to take some of their different heritage fruit grown on their property that grew over 4,000 years ago. Like the guava, the quince, and the figs, and we're turning that into jelly for them or jam to create an income stream to maintain the gardens so they can have more trees. They're all heritage trees. They start from seed, which is a wonderful, wonderful program. It's something that I highly support.
And that's called Mission Gardens?
Mission Gardens, yes. It's at the base of A Mountain. It's a beautiful garden, and they grow gourds and all the things. You know, for 4,000 years, we've had many people come to our territory and grow agriculture. So anywhere from, Native American, but Spaniards, the Chinese, people who have been visitors in our area and have stayed and bring their agricultural knowledge and seeds. And so there's many influences in that garden from such a variety of people that it's a tremendous educational area to take people, but definitely one to support.
Oh, I will look that up and put the link to their site in the show notes to encourage people to go.
Great.
My mom would love that. For those who are listening and thinking of expanding their brand and reaching further into the retail market, I'm curious about how you took your business from your kitchen to the shelves of Whole Foods. I mean, outside of just incredible perseverance, how did you crack the code to do that?
Oh, I would encourage anyone who comes up with a great product and they think it just is an exceptional product that they want to get on the market to have tenacity, have patience, and have innovation, because you need to create a product that's maybe different on the market or better on the market. I would highly suggest that you use ingredients that are healthy, they're unadulterated, they're chemical-free, and they're flavorful. Then I would advise someone to have what we call a clean label. And that simply means listing ingredients that people can recognize and pronounce at the same time. So
sad that that's a unique quality.
Yes, yes. But that's what the millennials are going for today.
Yes.
And that's what all of us, we want to be healthy and have wonderful, healthy lives. And so we're looking for that. I would also suggest that you avoid preservatives, additives, coloring. Customers today want nutritious, delicious, natural, or organic. That's just a huge segment of our population that want that and asking for it. Customers also like the story behind the product. So if you developed a product, they want to know the source of ingredients, the aspects, the positive aspects of the ingredients. But if you can incorporate how it was maybe sustainably grown, how you came up with that idea, people love the story and are actually willing to pay more money for that end product because there is a base, there is a story behind that product.
Mm-hmm. And did you find that when you were pitching to companies like Whole Foods that the representative found your story appealing, that was part of their thought process, that they want to support businesses who align with their values?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And because we work with sustainable products, we're good for the environment. You know, those are their philosophies as well. So yes, absolutely. They do have the same feelings that we do, that we honor the natural products that we have out there and want to make sure that our customers not only get a good, flavorful product, but they enjoy consuming it and know the story behind it.
That's interesting. And it's reassuring to
Absolutely.
Know that your story still matters and that it isn't just, you know, A ingredient plus B ingredient equals C profit. And that's just the bottom line, that they are trying to nurture some of these smaller manufacturers who align with their value system. They're trying to put good, clean product out into the public sphere, and they're eco-friendly. I'm really I'm relieved to hear that that still matters.
Oh, absolutely. and the philosophy that Whole Foods has now is growing into so many different directions. Trader Joe's, all of these bigger entities are taking that philosophy, and regular grocery stores now. Mm-hmm. You'll see sections now where it's all on the natural, mm-hmm. and the organic, and the companies with a story. So I think it's a great direction. Mm-hmm. We are pushing everyone to make a healthier product, a flavorful product, but also done it responsibly.
Mm-hmm. And vote with your wallet. If Absolutely. Those are things that are important to you, then support the businesses that represent them.
Absolutely.
My last question for you, if my listeners couldn't tell what a superstar you are already, you also serve on Tucson City of Gastronomy Board of Directors. And that is the organization that was responsible for obtaining Tucson's UNESCO designation. So what exactly is the UNESCO designation, and why is it significant for Tucson?
That's such a good question. UNESCO stands for United Nations Education, Science, and Cultural Organization. And it's founded the Creative Cities Network, started in 2004. And they currently have 180 cities in 72 countries that have some value to give to people. Whether it is in literature, it's in artwork. Ours, of course, is in food. Tucson was awarded the designation of being the Creative Cities of Gastronomy because the food here tells a story that dates back, again, 4,000 years. And the city's culinary culture and heritage is a tapestry of Mexican and American traditions, but also, as I had mentioned, the other country people that came from so many places throughout our world and introduced new foods to our area. So the City of Gastronomy Board, our job is to maintain that designation. And we do so by sponsoring chef exchanges, by sending board members and trained chefs to other creative cities, conducting classes, and being involved in events that support the education of our rich heritage here in Tucson. So we are graded by UNESCO every year to make sure that we are giving our community the best in food knowledge and utilizing our agriculture in such a wonderful way.
And Tucson's the only city in North America to have this designation. Is that correct?
We were the only one in the United States until last year. And San Antonio has now become a city of gastronomy well. So we are partnering with San Antonio. They've invited us to come help them develop their board and their ability to get the word out to the community. It's wonderful. People come here from all over the world. Just thinking this month with the rodeo and mm-hmm. the gym show, we have people come in from everywhere.
Yes.
And to be able to, for them to participate in our food system, our wonderful diversified restaurants out there that offer food that are indigenous to here and mm-hmm. And other things that they offer, I think it just goes to show you how Tucson is a rich resource of people and food and dynamic agriculture.
Well, thank you very much for answering all of my nosy questions.
Oh, thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And are you ready for the Proust lightning round?
I hope so.
The Proust questionnaire was a parlor game made popular by the French essayist and novelist Marcel Proust. He believed that by answering 35 specific questions, an individual reveals their true nature. We're going to go through as many questions as we can in 3 minutes. Are you ready?
I will try.
Okay. The first is, which words or phrases do you most overuse?
Oh, my, my. I would say natural. I would say flavorful. I think I've said that multiple times just today.
Hazards of the job.
Yeah. those two stand out to me.
What or who is the greatest love of your life?
Oh, well, my hubby, John Romanowski, and of course my three children, and we have an extended family that they are number one in my life.
That's sweet. I've met John. He's a very nice man. When and where were you happiest?
Oh, gosh, I'm always happiest with my children and my family, my husband. So I think my happy place is my home.
I like that. Which talent would you most like to have?
Well, I would love to sing, but I can't sing. So
just privately in your car.
Yes. So I will just be happy to be hopefully a good cook.
If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?
Oh, my gosh. Patience. I think I need to have a little more patience. Well, I'm kind of losing it as I get older. I'm in a hurry to get everywhere. And so I think I need to devote some time to creating that skill again of being patient.
If it's any consolation, I always think of you as being very patient. Uh-huh. Anyone who can do 2 years of R&D is a patient person. What is the quality you most like in a man?
Oh my goodness. Humor. I think that's what made me fall in love with John, is his humor and his gentleness as a human person, a human being, and honesty. I think those three things.
What is the quality you most like in a woman?
Honesty. Again, humor. Someone who's happy. Mm. Those are the qualities I like.
And on that happy note, you survived your lightning round.
Oh, yay!
Well done.
Thank you.
I would love to have you chime in at the end of our last segment. Dear Coach gives our listeners the chance to have their emailed questions addressed. And today's Dear Coach is about revamping the definition of sales. Everyone should have received their year-end financial reports by now, and you are likely starting to set revenue goals for this year if you haven't already. But there's that one word, sales, that sends shudders down the spines of many an entrepreneur. That singular word conjures up an image that I've had to help almost every client overcome. There is still this enduring image of a super slick, high-pressure, commission-driven salesman. Business owners need to realize that they do not have to replicate those tactics in order to effectively represent their own product or service. So to evict the sales boogeyman, let's imagine replacing the word sales with words like connection, communication, and education. In my opinion, sales is most effective when a consumer with a genuine need connects with a provider who has a genuine solution. There should never be a need to push or cajole a buyer into doing business with you. But in order for them to connect with you, you have to embrace the idea of communicating and educating. And I understand that this does involve a little bit of self-promotion, but actually, sales is never about you. It's about your audience. So when your focus is how you feel about sales, maybe on your fear around making enough money or fear of looking foolish or too pushy, you're missing out on opportunities to be of service to your customer. But if you focus your attention on using your knowledge and your experience to help another person who truly needs your help, that mindset shift can transform your attitude towards sales. I also think that one of the biggest challenges small business owners face is that traditional marketing strategies are biased toward extroverts. But many different types of people own businesses, and so not all of them are comfortable with the idea of public speaking, attending gala events, or just schmoozing in general. The key is to embrace what you are good at and what you do enjoy, and combine that with stretching yourself a little bit. And I do encourage you to stretch a little, because as business owners, you do have to adapt. You just don't have to adapt to the point of breaking, right? So, for example, I worked with a client who is a self-proclaimed introvert. She hated public speaking, and she was extremely nervous standing up for just 60 seconds in front of a group to talk about her services. But she chose a small networking group, and it provided a supportive environment for her to practice. She started to enjoy sharing her stories. She started injecting humor into her examples, and she rapidly bloomed into one of the group's favorite members. She didn't have to be on stage in front of hundreds to make a great impression. She just found a good niche where she could practice educating her audience, and in very short order, she became adept at doing so. So in the spirit of turning the word sales into the word education, here are a few suggestions that you can put into action starting today. Number one, think about a time when you worked with a customer and you thoroughly enjoyed the experience. You got to use your knowledge and skills, and they valued what you had to offer. How did that person find you? How did they initially describe their problem to you? Write down as much of what you can recall as possible. Step two, put on your consumer hat. Review what you wrote through their eyes. Are you able to clearly see what was most important to them? Are you using marketing language that is actually meaningful to your audience? Is it easy for them to find you, or was it random chance that they came across your business? Step three, write down just two things you will commit to doing with great consistency this year around your sales. And consistency is the key word. Maybe based on what you wrote, that means honing a good elevator pitch. So when someone asks, what do you do for a living? You can answer in a compelling way and not just sort of a boring, so-so, hemming-haw, vanilla milquetoast way, which is how most people answer that question. You want to further the conversation. Maybe that means that you refine your online presence using messaging that your audience really cares about and speaks to the issues they're turning to you to solve. And last but not least, practice the platinum rule. It's not about treating others as you wish to be treated. It's treating others as they wish to be treated. Remember, sales is not actually about you. It's about who you serve. So being in touch with what they're experiencing, what motivates them, and how they're feeling is much more important than what you think you would respond to. So Sherry, we have a couple of minutes left. Do you have any advice or lessons that you could add to that list?
Oh gosh, that was excellent. I thought, boy, I need to go write some notes down. I think the lesson I would like to impart to people is never fear to try. Failures invoke thinking, creativity, and innovation. And if you have all the qualities that I had mentioned earlier, and that's just being tenacious, and you love the product you want to get out on the market, then don't fear to try. Just keep trying and keep going at it, because it'll come true someday.
I love that. I think tenacity should be the word for 2019.
Amen.
And on that tenacious note, it brings us to the end of today's episode. Just one more reminder that my dynamic marketing workshop on Friday, March 8th, is ideal for business owners looking to connect with top dollar clients, but without high pressure sales. You can find additional details on the Rising Effect Facebook page, or please email me at stephanie@therisingeffect.com. If you have a question or problem you'd like for us to talk about during our Dear Coach segment, please email me once again at stephanie@therisingeffect.com. You can also find today's show notes at businessradiox.com/Tucson. My thanks again to my guest, Sherry Romanofsky of Sherry's Desert Harvest, my producer, Mark Bishop, and to you for joining us on Small Biz, Big Voices.